Welcome to Season 9, Episode 20 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we talk about vehicles. Yes, that's right, the things you drive and other forms of conveyance. We also delve into superstitions and folklore in your game setting. Again, welcome to Season 9, Episode 20 of RPG Circus. My name, of course, is Jeff, and joining me this episode is Chris and Paul. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello.
Video.
Feels good. You know, couple week break. I think we did pretty well in the last episode, and, you know, last couple of it's been a weird couple of weeks. You know, I think everyone's been busy. I don't know. The fall is always weird. And, of course, this is technically the second day of October as we record this. Hence the Halloween season. Yep, hence the superstitions and folklore. Actually, it is the RPG blogger's topic of the month is superstitions.
Oh, interesting.
So yeah, I thought that was we could do a little bit on that, because I'm always a fan of if we can steal a topic from what the monthly blogging topic is. That's always a good thing. So, well, but
absolutely,
yeah. And first up, of course, let's go into vehicles, because that's what I put at the top of the agenda. Any arguments with that?
Nope.
Good, because otherwise I might have to run you over with my car, right?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I am certainly on a roll today. Bad. That was a bad pun, and I didn't even plan that one.
Nice.
Man, gotta let it ride.
Yeah, I cannot. I really don't like people who, you know, can't at least let out at least one pun every once in a while.
I don't think that's going to be a problem.
No, I don't think that's ever been a problem with gamers. I've never met a gamer that doesn't do puns at some level.
Well, again, it's wordplay. It's what we do. And that sounds like a great topic for another one.
Yeah. But let's get on to vehicles and other, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know where you wanted to go with this first off.
Mostly I was just throwing stuff against the wall and seeing what stuck. But ultimately, it's probably the most common thing that you don't see anything topic about when it comes to various broadcasts or blogs.
Well, it's a tough thing. Mm-hmm. And I think the meta question always is, for vehicles, is it something that's real, like, is it equipment or is it a plot device? In a way.
Also, is it worth incorporating what a lot of systems implement as rules for vehicles?
Into absolutely. The game? I mean,
because that changes the nature of a session and possibly even the game itself.
Oh, right.
So, yeah.
I mean, you look at a game like the Hero System, where the vehicle is built with its own set of points.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. That, I mean, the vehicles in question become a character onto itself, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and frequently your vehicle rules are completely separate from the rest of the rules, to the point where they may not even use the same dice sometimes,
right,
to resolve things. And it becomes this entirely other thing, because unless you spend all of your time in your vehicle, getting in that vehicle, you're like, okay, do we want to get into the subsystem that we haven't touched in 6 months?
Well, I'm thinking of MechWarrior is a good example of that. Robotech is a good example of that. Car Wars has the opposite problem, because Car Wars is really a board game, but inside that board game were some micro rules where you could have drivers that had skills.
Yeah, well, yeah, but let's be honest. If you weren't in the arena, it really didn't matter.
Right. But, I mean, you know, in many ways, some people would argue that the cars in Car Wars are the characters, and the drivers are just ancillary, and you could do, you know, so I've known people that used Car Wars as kind of an RPG adventuring system, depending on what they were doing, because they, you know, mm-hmm. Even though it is it's one of those weird ones. It is a board game, but definitely Car Wars, definitely I know for a lot of people, how do I say this? Really brought to the forefront the concept of vehicles in a game.
it's like a, I say it's almost like a virtual model game, even though you don't actually build the models, because you spend a lot of hours building your vehicle.
Oh, yeah.
If you're really into it, like popping the hook, figuring out if you have the right chassis, the right engine, the right
arm. Oh,
the right
yeah. Vehicles. There's all sorts of, I mean, I think it's one of the, I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things, like, it's like the Traveler with the Trillion Credit Squadron tournament thing. There was a guy who actually used a computer program to design ships, and they kept changing the rules. And every time they changed the rules, he would rebuild his computer model to build, so he could know how to build better ships just to satisfy that tournament. And they actually had him stop. They had actually had to ban him from tournaments. Well, because what the ships that the computer were coming up with as winners, which did win, was counterintuitive to the way everyone thought you should design ships. So, you know, because you'd have these guys with really fast ships, and the truth be told, it didn't need fast ships for certain things. Or he would build, like, basically squadrons of fighters and throw them out there. And it's like, well, you know, enough fighters against a really large capital ship, the fighters are going to just swarm it. And eventually, yeah, you may destroy half the fighters, but who cares? So, you know.
I'd say the single most important thing when it comes to vehicles, it comes to three words that I actually got from the Muppet Show. Is the whole point of the vehicle to travel by map? Like, is the whole point to go from point A to point B, and it doesn't really matter what happens otherwise? If so, you don't need to build a vehicle. You just need to go, we're going to hop in a vehicle, and we're going to end up from point A to point B. Kind of like so a lot of RPGs have, like, subway systems. And you hop on, you go on there, you might have a random encounter at most in order to do anything. Hence the abstraction versus realism. Also, what do you do with a vehicle when you play with it in the game? Ultimately, it's transportation. Often acts as essentially a glorified bus for your party. Storage, you know, let's be honest. Any game where you can collect crap and you don't have, like, a magical bag of holding, it's going to go into your vehicle.
Whatever that may be, in a fantasy campaign, that could be a cart. Matter of fact, in the Solomon King game that I'm currently running, that's why they have a cart.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, because it's like... Wagon. Yeah, cart, wagon, canoe.
Are there a
canoe.
Lot of cart chases going on?
No. But, I mean, they have chased a guy on horse.
Nice.
You know.
Probably the most insane transportation I've ever had in a fantasy campaign is a chase that involves sedan chairs. Yes. It was a Roman campaign.
Mm.
Okay. That's part of the fun. Also, it's often used as essentially a weapon armor platform.
Oh, yeah. That's one of those things that I'm just like, really? You know, I mean, it is. I mean, we've mentioned Card Wars. We've mentioned Mech Warrior. We've mentioned Traveler and the Trillion Trillion Squadron. And really, I mean, it really is.
Would be in there, too.
What was that?
Mm-hmm. Riffs.
Well.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I agree completely on
that. I mean, anything with Mecha, anything. I mean, well, just about anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, dude, the second you mount a vehicle in your car that you can actually get away with it without getting pulled over by the cops, it's a game changer. Even if it's only just a slightly larger caliber than you can carry normally. Because then you can literally shoot down targets that are civilians or pedestrians with relative ease, and plus you got better armor because you're always, you know, the bigger the frame, the more armor you can put on it. You know, it's only so much armor you can put on a body, but there's a lot more you can put around your car, much less a tank or a mecha or a spaceship. You know? And, ultimately, other things you can do is sensors. Like, let's be honest, that's the main reason you ride around in Star Trek. Sensors indicate insert name here.
Well, I mean, again, I say, especially like in a scenario like Star Trek, most of the time, I mean, if you take like the classic series, the starship itself is a plot device to get the players from point A to point B and to provide them a mobile base, or just it's just part of the plot. It's there. It's like in a lot of games, you almost wouldn't need stats because you don't really, you know. Contrary, I mean, especially when you look at the original series, there's very little ship to ship combat in the original series.
Like, yeah, what's that story that I think it was GMS said or somebody else of major sci-fi pronoun? It moves at the speed of plot.
Right.
You know. And ultimately, it's there to set up the actual plot device. Plus, because it's a set piece, you basically have, when you deal with the really large vehicles, it's essentially a mobile castle or dungeon or village.
Right.
They can be anywhere there. Like, I've been watching The Last Ship lately, and even a battleship is, well, it's got its own map, it's got multiple stories, you put it anywhere on the, across the coast, and you can go conceivably anywhere along the coast.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, I look at it from my own traveler experience. It's like, you know, I've taken, like, one of the classic Far Trader traveler maps, printed it out, you know, and I've had adventures inside, obviously, the starship. Because it is, you know, granted the players know their way around, which is why you just, it's like, you know the layout of your own ship, you don't need, but it still is a dungeon. Or if you go on to a phantom starship, all of a sudden it is a dungeon. I'm thinking there's an adventure in Traveler where the players go to a lab ship and they're investigating a lab ship and there's some sort of weird mutated virus or something or on it that they have to deal with. Or, you know, there's actually one where there's an alien starship and you investigate the alien starship. Well, the alien starship is the dungeon. You know, the fact that you might have some minor stats on it are really immaterial. You know, and in many cases, and that's what I mean, you know, it's like you really almost don't, for most games, your vehicles don't need stats. You know, outside of, you know, it's like, I mean, take even Star Wars. I mean, to a certain degree, you almost don't want stats on your vehicles. You know, it's like, do you really want to know what an Imperial Star Destroyer will do against some other capital ship? Not really, because you're not going to really have capital ship battles.
No.
You know, you might have small, but I mean, even something like the Millennium Falcon, it really is just a device to get the players from point A to point B, and, oh, it just happens to people think it's the fastest flying hunk of junk in the galaxy.
Yep.
You know, so that's really just flavor text on that location that moves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's big enough that you have a couple of areas. You can train in one room. You can sort stuff in others. You can smuggle yourself in another category. And you still got your basic weapons and armor. And if you end up fighting TIE fighters, those are set positions. You just roll dice against the guy's gunner skill.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's the common mistake sometimes we make in game where we really do want to get down. I think it's our, I don't know, it's weird because on the one hand, we want to tactically do everything in it. And I know some people are like, oh, I don't believe that. No, I think in a lot of games, you know, whether you use miniatures or not, you know, when you do combat, a lot of combat gets to be very tactical. So you're like, oh, well, if I'm going to have starship combat, you don't want to abstract that out. And I for certain games, I get it. You know, it's part of the fun. You know,
it takes away from it, though, too, to a certain extent. I mean, especially if you're talking about, like, starship combat or any kind of large vehicle combat where you are in an environment that might be hostile to your own personal survival without special equipment in the middle of the ocean, out in, you know, in the Arctic or something like that. If your spaceship gets blown up, you know, which might be through no fault of your own, you know, as a GM, you're like, you got away, I guess? I mean, you really have to kind of GM hammer that into place. So there is a certain amount of, you know, that when you put those in there, do you have to let your players know that there's an outcome that they might not have anything to do with?
Mm-hmm. That actually brings up one of my favorite interesting dilemmas when it comes to vehicle. What can your characters do inside the vehicle, and what can they do outside the vehicle? Because nothing sucks more than waiting on a vehicle. Let's say you're a really good shot with a gun, or no, you're a really good medic, and you should be running around in the ship, but the glory is going to the pilot and the gunner. You know, and you're basically just sitting there, Like, that's one of the few good things I really like about Rogue Trader from the 40K game, is every character is built to be able to do something within the ship and outside the ship.
Oh, interesting.
So you always have a position and you can do something.
If you abstract out vehicles, how does that affect the usage and the purchase, especially for something like GURPS or Champions or something like that, the purchase and use of piloting skills? If you say we're going to abstract out vehicles to conveyances, what's the point of ever taking a piloting skill or a gunnery skill to be used while in a vehicle?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because ultimately those are going to be too high stats if it's like a MechWarrior game. Because the rest really don't matter except for weird situational things when you're inside. And when you get those, then you're doing a much smaller game, but that's not why you brought to the dance in the first place. Your job was to drive big, giant mecha. And that's just part of the fun. Or you can also do stuff like, often when you're fighting vehicles versus non-vehicles, it's usually horribly lopsided. Unless you got like a Jedi on the other side.
Yeah, you know, well, and I mean, I remember playing games of Twilight 2000.
I was going to ask about that one. Go ahead.
Oh, what? Twilight 2000?
Yeah.
Why? Because vehicles are...
I was just wondering how they handled vehicles in there. I've looked at the system a couple of times, but never enough to really come to grips with, you know, really get into the vehicles part.
So well, I'm just wondering kind of how they handle vehicles are just like any other damage. It's on the same damage scale.
Okay.
So, you know, things that damage vehicles do a lot of damage, and most people would be dead. So, but I mean, it is. I mean, it's like you can obviously with like, oh, I have an anti-tank shoulder launched rocket. I might be able to take out a light, you know, armored vehicle. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and you might get a lucky shot on a tank. But yeah, I mean, in those cases, I mean, and I think that's what it is. I mean, it's tough because, again, you know, depending on the nature of the game or what it's trying to simulate, you know, determines how vehicles are portrayed in the game even. You know, again, something like Twilight 2000, vehicles are going to have a bunch of crunchy stats, you know, even sometimes if they don't make sense because, you know, people, it's a military game, it's, you know, military setting, and you're expecting, oh, I'm going to at least at some point probably run into at least a light armored vehicle or a tank or, you know, even as a ground force unit. And, you know, and in many cases, you know, something like that, infantry against an armored vehicle, typically you would just avoid if you could.
Yep.
And, you know, and that gets back to what kind of game are you playing, you know, is, you know, if you're throwing vehicles at people that don't have a vehicle, it's really a plot device to, you know, maybe it's something that they need to go around. Maybe it's something that, you know, again, like you said, maybe the vehicle is the dungeon. Maybe you have to sneak onto the vehicle and then fight it from the inside. You know, I mean, I think there's even like, I want to say there was like a D&D module where I would classify it as a vehicle. It's like some sort of big, almost like mechanical monstrosity. And it was a dungeon the way they did the adventure.
I was also wondering. So I was reading a book today about combat and stuff like that, and they're talking about maintenance on vehicles, and you know, especially for like something like Twilight 2000, I could see how you could actually use that vehicle as a focal point for adventures. I mean, this book is a nonfiction called How to Make War by James Dunnigan. And he's talking about maintenance on tanks is sometimes as much as 8 hours a day.
Oh,
after they've run for a single day.
Yeah, I don't.
That's a built-in adventure generator practically right there.
Yeah. Well, the other big thing, like in Twilight 2000, was fuel. That was actually another big one, and it's like almost everyone, you know, had some sort of ethanol distillery that they would haul around. And of course, if you were smart, that was the first thing you destroy off the enemy. If they, see, they have their distillery. Target that first.
Yep.
You know, and they had some conceits where it's like, well, all the vehicles, no matter what, at some point probably had some sort of conversion to do ethanol. And they just assumed it was equal to regular fuel, I think. I actually forget. You know, even the tanks. Oh, well, they were multi-fueled vehicles. Like, yeah, not really. Really?
That also reminds me of why so many bloody vehicles and rifts are nuclear powered, because they don't want to really deal with fueling.
Well, actually, you know, it's funny because there's another game, the Mara Project. I think you guys heard me mention that before, right?
Yep.
Same thing. It's like a weird conceit in the game. I mean, these guys are, especially the edition that I have, which was made in the 80s, you know, all the equipment is like circa Vietnam, except for the vehicles that are nuclear powered. You know, it's like, it's a Jeep, but it's nuclear powered. What?
It'll run for 1,000 years and like,
right.
Well, yeah, I can't get my Chevy to keep running for 6 months straight.
And again, they did that because they wanted to give the people vehicles, but they didn't want to deal with fuel problems, fuel supplies. And I think that's a lot of vehicle. I mean, I think that's a lot of games. I mean, you take even Traveler. Yeah, you have to refuel your vehicle, but it's almost an afterthought because fuel, most starships have fuel for weeks or a month minimum. So unless you really run it to the edge, you have enough fuel to at least power the basic power plant to move the vehicle at least within normal space. You know, fuel only becomes a real concern when you're jumping through, you know, doing jumps because it eats up a lot of fuel. You know, and it's just like, okay, you know, and even then it's like you keep a track of your fuel that you have for jumps and your other fuel, even though it's the same fuel supply, it's like, oh, I can do a jump, you know, a 2-parsec jump, and I still have fuel for a month. So between all that, it's like I can fly into the system. I mean, I can fly out to my jump where I need to jump, which takes a week, get there, and then fly wherever I'm at, and still probably have 5 or 6 days of just maneuvering around fuel.
Mm-hmm.
So it's there, but it's like it's almost like you just it's like, oh yeah, I've got to the planet. We need to buy fuel, or you know, especially in Traveler. Oh, there's a gas giant. I'm going to skim the gas giant. There's free fuel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it kind of becomes a little, it's there, but it's almost an afterthought in a way.
Well, there's this joking night to the dinner table where they're running a space campaign. They basically were joking how the GM, I was absolutely adamant the hydrogen was a rare commodity for the ship. And it was just, they were saying, no, it actually can be easily filtered off of like half a dozen different stellar bodies. You just need to basically, you know, feed off it.
Right.
And if that's the case, then fuel becomes essentially meaningless, which is kind of defeats the purpose of having a vehicle in the first place. Like, if you're going to have something that big and powerful, there needs to be some sort of countermeasure if that becomes the focus of the game.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you have to decide the role of vehicles in your game. In something like Twilight 2000, you could easily base your almost, you know, a large portion of your adventures around keeping your vehicle running as you make a, you know, make a beeline for a coastal port or something like that.
Right. But I mean, I've
like
played
a
Twilight
Star Trek game. It's just a vehicle.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking, I've played a few Twilight 2000 campaigns where, you know. Yeah, someone started off with a tank, and by Adventure 4, for whatever reason, that thing was a smoking hulk.
Oh, dude, you shoot enough artillery at that thing, it's gone.
Yeah. So
there was that, yeah.
Actually, I think in one case it was just a lucky hit with a law rocket.
Oh, dude, that'll do it.
You know.
There's the anti-tank weapons. You know, they, yeah.
So.
Another day. But as far as overall plots... What sort of plots can you actually have that are actually vehicle focused? Like I came up with racing, duels, you know, auto duels,
right.
War, couriers, and fetch quests. I'm just trying to think if there's any other categories that might be able to use if you decide to become a bunch of speed racers, for lack of a better term.
What did you have?
Oh, racing.
Right.
Auto duels, because
auto duels.
Basically war games where you have either a tank or you have you know, you're on planes or you're on a ship. The idea of being a courier, because that's always a standard campaign. You have to deliver this package within a week. And you got your Ford Subaru that's been souped up. You got to go across America. Good luck, folks.
Cannonball Run. Oh, I get it.
Cannonball Run. You got it.
You could do kind of a rebuild scenario where you might be stranded on a planet and you are trying to rebuild either a contemporary or an older spaceship and trying to gather parts for it in order to leave the planet in a certain time frame. That time frame might be, you know, decades, or it might be just a couple of weeks, depending on what the tech level of the planet is and how familiar you are with the other spaceship and that kind of thing. So you could make it kind of a, I don't know if that's really kind of a reverse fetch version.
Well,
so.
I think that's almost like Junkyard Wars, where you basically have a bunch of junk and you got to build it together.
I love, so. Yeah. I still remember this an episode of Junkyard Wars where it was an American team, a British team, and a Russian team. And it was like they had to build like some sort of all-terrain vehicle that had like some aquatic capabilities, like they could, it would actually could float even with like stuff that they added, and float, do a little water course, and then get back on. And it was just so interesting how different people's mind worked. It's like the Russian design was really bizarre, but it's like that's the way they would think about it. Unlike us, mm-hmm. which I think the Americans, the vehicle, their base vehicle was something like some V8 engine. You know, the British was like some sort of V6 engine, and the Russians had like some sort of weird like motorcycle trike thing going on.
Nice.
So
interesting.
Exactly. And if you're building your vehicle, that might actually add a lot of soul to the thing. Like yesterday, we're playing my Space Ninjas game, and we're actually involved in one of these. It actually involved in a race. And the first question I asked is, okay, what's one power from your character you want to be able to transplant into the vehicle? So that way you're basically rolling the same dice and you're just using it as a projection. You know what I mean? I added my teleporting ability for my ninja and basically created a Nishi drive where you could basically hop short distances, you know, for various reasons. And if that's the case where you're basically, like if you're playing a superheroes campaign, you can basically use your powers within the vehicle as an extension. That solves a lot of problems right there.
Well, you also have the Iron Man kind of thing too. So, I mean, because his suit is a vehicle. It provides him transportation far faster than he could ever move. It's armored. It's armed. So, I mean, you also have like a personal type vehicle too. So that could certainly be... a fundamental part of a campaign, whether it be superheroes or, you know, kitchen sink post-apocalypse like Rifts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Like you could have your entire squad of Samus suits flying over the place acting as first contact in the name of Coalition until something goes horribly wrong because it's Rifts. Yeah. And, well, I guess, ultimately, which genres are vehicles really important in?
I would say, oddly, space games tend to be more important.
Mm-hmm.
Even yeah. if they're even if it's not something you have stats for, but just like things that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
Probably more modern day tends to be a little bit more vehicle oriented, just because you know. But I mean, even when you get to fantasy, any type of transportation becomes important. Be it, you know. The horse and cart, a winged Pegasus, a winged horse, you know, or, hey, I fly in the back of a dragon, whatever. You know, in some ways, you know, you could argue that if you had a society that had a bunch of flying dragons, the dragons themselves are the vehicles.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're mm-hmm. definitely the power source, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I think you don't see as much vehicle focus in Cyberpunk. That being said, I did run a Shadowrun game that was... very vehicle-centric, unfortunately. But I don't see as heavy an emphasis on necessarily vehicles in Cyberpunk. That seems to be a much more personal, usually a personal genre where you're, you know, where it's more about against you against the system or your group against the system kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, like Call of Cthulhu is the same way. I mean, no matter almost what setting you play it in, it's like the vehicles are just, they're there. Like, oh.
Yeah.
You know, again, mm-hmm. it's the dungeon, like, they have, I know they have, what is that Orient Express one? Is it, I forget.
No, I know which one you're talking about, but the sense of the train becomes a sense.
Yeah, it's a nice set, too, because it has, like, train cars that you set out.
Yeah.
Horror on the Orient Express.
Okay, there you go. I only played that once or twice. You know, Day of Venture. So, yeah, again, it depends on. I think it just depends on the setting of the game setting itself. I mean, it doesn't almost matter whether it's fantasy or science fiction. It just kind of matters what's going on. Because obviously, let's take, you know, you can have a science fiction game where the vehicles are there, but maybe not as important. Like, you know, like let's take like Stargate as a setting. Well, unless you count the Stargates themselves as vehicles, but again, they're more of a plot device. It's like, hey, that's how you get planet to planet for the most part. Now they do. Yep. As you, if you take the TV series into account, obviously, even the movie, you know, obviously there are other starships and vehicles, but again, they're almost a plot device or, you know, a mobile dungeon for all practical purposes. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, you got to fit it through the Stargate if you're going to use it worth a darn. And it's either going to be a probe or a jeep that basically fits within there, or the puddle jumpers of Atlantis. where if it doesn't fit through, it's not going to be useful, and therefore you're limited by size and scope.
Right. Which, you know, for a game is not too bad.
Yeah. You know. If anything, I think that would be a great limiting factor if you decide to play a Stargate campaign.
Yeah.
That way you can't just drive all over the place. You got to wait for the gates.
Right.
I think I wonder if maybe genre has more to do with the importance of vehicles than, you know, the type of game. Like, for example, like horror, I don't think you see a lot of emphasis on vehicles either.
No.
In fantasy, you know, transportation's a big thing because you have to get from point A to point B. You're usually going places and doing things.
Yeah. But in fantasy, unless it's like a boat, you know, a ship or a boat, typically it's walking with maybe some horses.
Yeah.
So it's a little more limited.
It may be epic, but you go from point A to point B.
Yeah.
Now, if I just say one that actually vehicles become incredibly important, it's actually the post-apocalyptic, because like I mentioned, two different extremes that both use vehicles in pretty intense contexts. Mad Max the Road Warrior, which is your typical guys in football gear riding around in motorized vehicles, and the opposite, which is Turbo Kid, which everybody rides around on bikes. So literally, because there's no, you know, there's no gas anymore, everybody is basically, no matter how badass you are, you're riding around in a BMX because there's no fuel anymore.
I've never heard of that one.
Oh, Turbo Kid is an amazing movie.
I might have to check that out.
Okay. So, you know, of course you got the World War and World War II, where basically you become cogs within the machine, or the Cold War. And if you got low enough powered superheroes, you got some of the most iconic vehicles in fiction, like the jets of the Avengers, or the Blackbird of the X-Men, because you got to get the party somehow there.
And right. Not everyone can fly.
Yeah. Nope. Well, and I think that's what it is. A lot of times, no matter what the game setting is, it the vehicle really is just a way to get the players from point A to point B with some sort of explanation. If you use that definition for vehicles, you'd almost, even in Star Trek, you'd almost count the transporters as a vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's something that they don't they use, but don't, and that's actually contained within the starship, but it's not necessary. I mean, it reinforces the concept of certain things are more plot device than anything else.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely.
So just a few thoughts. I'd love to hear any of our listeners' thoughts on vehicles. I mean, and how important they are to the game. I mean, is it more important to have a vehicle that, I mean, do they use vehicles but the stats are not important, or do you use vehicles in a game that is very, where the stats for the vehicle are super important? And the only way that I think that they could be super important is if you're in a game where everyone's in a vehicle 90% of the time.
Yeah, because nothing sucks more than having a great pilot that never is loved within his vehicle. You know, basically your baby driver, and you're basically hanging out for half the adventure in the back skirts. You're very important, you're necessary, but that would be almost like what you do with a netrunner. Yeah. You're relegated to an NPC.
Well, I think that's what happens. I think that's the balancing act with vehicles, where if you have vehicles and you have a game that has vehicles and you have players that want to be effectively pilot or drivers, they have to have, you're right, they have to have something that outside of the vehicle they can do.
Mm-hmm.
And vice versa, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, when you're in a, I mean, think about even in a space game, it's like you have a lonely engineer. Well, that's great. You have to have an engineer, but what does he really do? you know, it's like, so it's nice if the rules take that into account, or you make some sort of thing that, okay, well, he's important in combat besides just doing quick repairs. Maybe he can provide more power, you know, whatever. Again, that's outside the scope, I think, of what we're talking about, but it is something that, you know, again, you know, players don't need to feel helpless, and I think that's why I've never liked netrunning and Cyberpunk, because there's no way to involve all the players.
Right.
And that's one of the biggest problems until recently, until they realized that we have Wi-Fi and the netrunner should respond in real time like everybody else. Like, it's cool to build things like black ice and so forth and build these essentially one-man dungeons. But what's everybody else doing?
Right, and I think that's the, yeah, that, and I think especially like, I think Cyberpunk 2020, when they had that, that was one of their additions. It was like, oh, well, the guy can do some quick edits or some weird thing. where they're not actually super net running, but they can do things that affect things. So,
yeah. Mm. Well, again, I always fall back when it comes to hacking. Like, I think we did an episode on already with Felicity from Arrow, where she's actively involved in everything, but she's not having her own little adventure. She opens doors, she unlocks things, she deciphers things and sends information onwards. She's tech support. And that's important for your group of little vigilantes in the field.
Right. And I think that's where, depending on the game, NPCs are so important because they provide hero support. For lack of a...
Hero support is very important, especially running like a superhero campaign. In fact, that'd be kind of a fun side game where you're basically playing hero support for some superhero.
Actually, actually it's funny that in Champions, one of the old Champions, they actually had a super agent supplement. Okay. And that was one of the options was that I think for one of the organizations is like basically, you know, you take care of all the stuff that when the superheroes aren't available. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was funny. And I always thought that that'd be a great game to play. And it's like the way the rules were written, I'm like, this game would be perfect to run like a G.I. Joe scenario where, you know, not all the agents look alike and people can still have specialized gear, but then they have to know how to build the gear. You know, there was some, because every player got, well, you got X number of points for equipment. Well, you know, you can choose and agency standard gear, but you can build your own specialty gear because it's just points. And I always thought that would have been a cool game to play or run, you know, where it's like, oh, well, yeah, we're the super agents, but we get to build our own equipment, so we're almost kind of like low-powered supers.
Exactly.
So, just one of those things.
Okay, well, we're almost done here. I will bring up the concept. Is there one vehicle and one piece of media when it comes to vehicles, both within gaming and without, that particularly catches your fancy? Like, I think it's safe to assume Car Wars usually plays a role when it comes to, like, you know, the RPG to beat all RPGs when it comes to vehicles. Uncle Al's Catalog from Hell.
Oh, yeah.
It is still a fun book to read, even if you're not into the crunch.
It
does feel like an advertisement.
Honestly, I think, for me, the vehicle books that always caught my attention for games was Twilight 2000, like the U.S. and Soviet vehicle guides.
I could see that.
Because they had some really nice drawings for, you know, like, I think in the center they had, like, a few pages of really high-color gloss drawings for various vehicles. Mm-hmm. And so that always caught my attention.
Oh, definitely.
And of course, I wouldn't even say reference books per se, but anytime I ever see good traveler image drawings of things like the scout ship or the Far Trader, it's like I would take one of those.
Yeah.
So that's just me.
Okay. What about you, Paul?
For me, I would probably have to say, this is kind of a cheat, but not really. I've always loved the idea of generational starships, and in fact, I've written a novel about one. I'd have to go with Metamorphosis Alpha, one of the original science fiction RPGs set on a giant generational starship. The idea of being, you know, parts of it breaking down into, you know, lower levels of society and technology, and then other parts remaining at the level of the starship, and, you know, having miles and miles and miles of corridors and, you know, domes and all these things to roam. You know, it is effectively a giant dungeon of sorts, but it's still, I think, it's always an idea I've been intrigued by.
I can believe that. In fact, Goodman Games just came out with a mother of all, essentially, they did Star Lost. And they did a book that's like the spaceship is basically a generational spaceship going through space. It's bigger than most cities.
That was a terrible show.
Oh, yeah.
It was a terrible show, but I always liked the general premise of it.
Well, exactly. Yeah, that's why I picked it up. I'm like, a generational starship. I'm all over this. And it,
Well, it's 70s Canadian sci-fi, which means it was boring as dishwater.
It just never really, it kind of half delivered for most part. I mean, I know that they had a lot of Harlan Ellison scripts in it, but yeah, it just never really kind of, it never became what I thought it could have been.
Well, it feels like, well, it's 70s TV.
There is that.
A lot of walking, a lot of boring action, because they think the concept alone can carry the story instead of actually trying to build up certain story arcs.
Yep.
But, yeah, and of course, I think we can, well, unless there's any other things, I'm just going to mention two words to finish this series, Knight Rider. And you'll know why.
Because it's a talking car?
You're old.
Well, dude, it's one of the first, you know, it's an example of an AI TV show where basically you watch it for the car and pretty much nothing else.
Well, yeah, I mean, you also listed Airwolf, which was another one, definitely during the 80s, that you really watched it just for the helicopter scenes, which were reused over and over and over in every episode.
Well, they were good scenes, but yeah, I don't even know how a rocket would work, you know.
Yeah.
Rocket jets on helicopter.
It doesn't.
Yeah, I had a feeling that's the case.
You know, it's funny, though, that the Sikorsky aircraft that was that vehicle, they, after the show ended, it got converted back, I think, to a Haas, a medical aid helicopter somewhere, and it eventually crashed.
Wow.
That's not good.
Well, yeah.
What a way to
go. It's just one of those things. It just happens. I only know that because, I don't know, I was looking it up one time. And it's one of those weird shows that I think they keep trying to say, we should do a movie on that. It's like, yeah, well, whatever.
Dude, as much as I love that car, its era is over.
Yeah, you know, they tried to do a new Knight Rider series, and I don't think that went very well. There was,
well,
that
Airwolf was a movie first, though, wasn't it?
It was a two-part pilot.
Was that a two-part pilot? Because the stars changed after that.
No, you're thinking after, like, I think season 3 or whatever it was something completely different. It was it had the Airwolf name, and the USA Network funded it because it allowed them to give enough episodes for syndication.
Okay.
Yeah, I know all sorts of weird things, and don't ask me why, because I just, you click on a link and you're like, wow, that's interesting. It just keeps going. So,
okay.
Yeah, all right. So, shall we get on to the other topic, which is basically superstitions and folklore? You guys good with that?
That works.
Yep.
Yeah, and this is kind of our October beginning of Halloween kind of talk. And, you know, this was obviously the RPG blogger topic for this month, but it got me to thinking, because, you know, and mostly I'm not talking about actual superstitions and folklore, but, you know, in a lot of games, you know, a lot of the fantasy creatures that you run into and stuff are based off of various, at some point, early folklore superstitions, especially the folklore. But it got me to thinking that, well, you have a fantasy game, and what superstitions exist in a fantasy game that aren't true? Because, I mean, you know, when you have a fantasy game, usually it's like, oh, you know, they say not to do this. Well, and it usually is because it's actually true. But it does make you wonder if there's, like, if, you know, there are superstitions that society would follow, even though it may be completely untrue, but they believe it's true.
Well, it's collective cultural identity.
Right.
Everybody must wear a red hat on Sunday because it roots the god of hat making, for lack of a better term.
And I'm just thinking, it to me, it's like a wonderful, almost plot device, because, you know, the players could eventually find out whatever the thing isn't true, but it doesn't matter that they know it's not true. Everyone else still thinks it is.
Well, and then if you mix in a little bit of truth with that, just enough to either confuse the players or make it dangerous for them. You know, everybody has to wear the red hat, but it's not actually for the god of hat making. It's because there's a curse on the town that if they don't wear that hat on the Red Sunday, over time, it will, you know, the earth underneath them will degrade and eventually swallow the town up.
Yeah.
You know, something like that, where it's, you know, it's not actually, you're like, there's no god of hat making, but then you find, you dig, the players dig deeper and find out that there is something to it. It's just changed over time.
Well,
maybe,
and
maybe the name changes from, it's not, you know, it's a deity, but it's just some simple hat maker from the past who made contact with the evil gnomes under their woods and struck this agreement with them or something, thus creating a plot hook.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think that's the other thing. It's like, you know, to me, it's like, okay, you have folklore. You know, we all, you know, whatever you want to call folk, you know, lore, legends, whatever. And again, you know, some of it might be true, some of it's false, but I don't know. It's weird because, again, like I said, in most games, especially like fantasy games, it's like, oh, you know, there's this haunted woods. I mean, I almost want to say that. When I was thinking about this earlier today, and I know this is going to sound strange, I was thinking of Scooby-Doo.
Okay, mm-hmm. That makes sense.
And the reason I was thinking about Scooby-Doo was, it's like, what a weird society they live in where there has to be actual monsters somewhere. Because if, you know, because every episode they find a monster and it's fake, but somewhere there must have been real monsters. Because otherwise, why would anyone think the monsters are real?
And that was the brilliant thing about Scooby-Doo Mystery Incorporated, is they actually were monsters, and they used them relatively sparingly throughout the series. So not everything was, you know, most of them were people in rubber suits, but occasionally they would run into something that was not a person in a rubber suit. And I thought that was, you know, if you ever get a chance to watch that entire series, it's fantastic.
No,
yeah, and my personal favorite was how they brought up the fact, okay, there's talking animals. Why?
Mm-hmm.
And
nuclear war?
The reasoning is actually really dark. It's essentially a side effect of a Lovecraftian entity.
Yeah. It's a really good series, actually. I highly recommend it.
Wow. I don't think I actually ever seen that one.
I'll give you a clue. It's... They give Fred Jones... emotional and a story arc. Emotional development and a story arc.
I think there are three seasons of it, but anyway, sorry.
Yeah.
Okay, all right, well, there you go, folks. There's a recommendation for your cartoon viewing. You know, don't discount, you know, I think a lot of people discount cartoons sometimes as sources of decent entertainment, oddly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Thundar has been fuel for many and many a game. I've used Scooby-Doo, Ghostbusters, G.I. Joe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've used them all for games. It's all fair game, so to speak.
I still would love to see a good, maybe not an actual Thundar the Barbarian RPG, but something that could equate to that.
Ooh, I think I may know something. I know somebody... Who does their podcast? I think it's called Podcast at Ground Zero. Who does post-apocalyptic stuff? I think he's interviewing somebody who was working on the game.
Mm.
There's a couple of them out there.
Yeah.
So, but I think one of the things that you have to do is, you know, in order to kind of evoke that Thundar, I think you would need to, you know, go back to the original cartoon and really kind of plot out the places that they went and the things that they did in order to get that feel for the world. And I think, obviously, that would be infringing on some copyright issues with Warner Brothers, and they may or may not be so happy to have you do that.
Well,
Your best bet is to quote the original source, because every Thunder episode actually takes place in a different city, but it's actually that different city, and they actually list it out. So instead of picking, say, St. Louis, pick Kansas City.
Yeah,
and just kind of have the same homage.
Yep.
And you can basically say, I did a different interpretation of this thing and I used different cities, and then you fill in the holes, and then you have your own little world. You just change the names, you change the concepts just enough that you're not betraying copyright.
Yeah,
but that's neither here nor there. We're talking about superstitions,
right? But I mean, and so that actually, you know, but I love the concept of again, like I said, I hearken to, obviously, fantasy. But even in science fiction games, you know, you would think, oh, science. Because I remember reading in, one of the Traveler supplements. I actually think it was the Starship Operator's Guide, now that I think about it. And, you know, there's like there's the old timer sections where in each chapter, there's like this section where, you know, this little gray box where the old timer talks about something about that in that section. And I remember him talking about, it's like, he says, you know, he was talking about, I dim the lights every time I jump. You know, that's like a weird superstition, you know, you dim the lights before you jump because you need every spare, you know, watt of power to actually jump into hyperspace. You know, he was talking about how, you know, probably in modern day, that's not necessary, but I still dim the lights. And he was talking about, he talks about I'm not like the drawing who like have a set of gold coins, you know, the drawing coins underneath the jump drive, or, you know, I'm not like the Varger who beat the last passenger nearly to death before they jump. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's just like, so it's interesting, you know, obviously they can be plot devices. Could you imagine, you know, for some reason being on a Varger ship, not realizing that you're the last passenger and you're going to get beat to hell?
That doesn't sound like fun at all.
Or think about this. Think about if you have a Varger passenger who is like, he's not the last passenger, but somebody else is, and he starts beating the last passenger because he's so superstitious about the jump. Mm.
Yep.
So, I mean, I think that's where some of this can be great plot devices for an adventure, you know, or just like even a way to get the players involved in some way that they wouldn't be involved. Maybe that Varger passenger does kill the other person that they, instead of not almost beating him to death, he does beat him to death. And then, you know, you're searching that player, you know, that person's belongings because, oh, you know, you got to do something with it. And you find something weird else. You know, it's like it's a segue to, normally you wouldn't have checked the guy's luggage, but now you do because you need some sort of way to forward his possessions on to his next of kin.
Interesting.
And maybe there's something weird in that. I don't know. I my mind goes wild sometimes. And it's weird. And it's hard because sometimes I think of stuff and it's like, that's the last thing the players will ever want to do.
Yeah. Hey, that's a really good idea until you realize the players think it'll suck.
Right.
Yeah. And also, for some reason, superstition seems to be really overlapping with tradition. And any, say, military or civic organization, you have these weird quirky things that become enshrined as proper traditions within a scope. You know, like the typical coronation where you pour a bottle of wine over your head when it comes to a ship, you know, for coronation and stuff.
Well, breaking the bottle.
Breaking the bottle.
On the bow.
That must have come from somewhere.
Right.
Where?
Well, I mean, and then you take, like, even the simplest superstitions that we have, like knocking on wood. Why is that? Do you know?
Not off the top of my head.
I did know it at one time. I forgot what it was.
One of the ones that I've heard was that you know, people would knock on woods to appease the sprites that live in the wood, because if you didn't appease them, they would cause bad things to happen.
Yeah.
You know, right. And it's just like, you know, you dump salt, you throw it over your shoulder. Why? To appease the devil or entity that lives over that shoulder. Yep. You know. And
well, I guess another one of the things, just to kind of attach it here, is whether a superstition actually creates a mechanical effect on the game, or whether it's just plot hook or story arc.
Well, and that's an interesting question, because, again, especially like in the fantasy games, there's a lot of things that are more superstition. You know, not even superstition, but there's mechanics based on, you know, the original origin of a lot of things might be based on folklore or superstition in the past. You know, and actually that's one of the weird things I also thought about fantasy that's always odd, because you have a lot of spellcasters, especially in games. And a weird trope in a lot of early, you know, in a lot of early games is like, oh, the wizard should be distrusted, but yet that never happens in a lot of games. It's like, nobody cares that there are wizards. Oh, wizards are all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like there's this loss of, I don't know. I think I've said this before, but I just find that there's a lot of games that are so magic rich that, you know, oh, you do spells? Big deal. Your neighbor does spells. You know, the guy that's making your bread, he's a spellcaster too, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Well, basically, in a lot of ways, magic, especially when you get to high magic environments, essentially becomes a replacement for technology. And then when it gets to that point, then it loses a lot of its mystical lure. Whereas, in fact, you're probably reaching into the cosmos of the universe, the equivalent of the subatomic theory, wiggling your fingers, saying really cool words, and holding up weird artifacts and hoping for the best.
Yeah.
And unless there's a mechanical effect that bases it, it becomes conventional.
Yeah. But I guess, I mean, I don't know really where I'm going with this. It's just one of those things that it always bugs me that, you know, it's like we don't, and I think we've said this a lot on the game, it's weird that we don't really, there's a lot of tropes that are based in superstition that we don't really incorporate in the game, or if we do, it gets lost in translation because, you know, obviously that trope is, you know, based on a certain thing that you almost can't translate.
Yeah.
I mean, you list, you know, as in folklore, the old crone, you know, and it's like, yeah, you can have the old crone, but it almost becomes passé because, oh, it's another old crone.
It seems to be giving out yet again, being creepy and trying to lure small children in there.
Now, right.
The twist would be she's actually probably one of the most fundamentally decent people in the story, but usually a lot of the original folklore were essentially cautionary tales telling don't do this or this will happen.
Oh yeah, I
didn't end well.
Yeah, I love how the original Little Mermaid story, it did not end well. Thank you, Disney. That was a little too dark for
revision.
Well, yeah, I think that's just one of those things. But, you know, I mean, but again, you have superstitions and traditions, like you said, like, and I'm not trying to discount different religious beliefs, but like, you know, there are certain societies that, you know, touching the dead is bad.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like, you may have a group of people outside society that touch bodies.
Yep. The Untouchables or the Edda.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you basically, yes, I will kill you, but I ain't going to touch you afterwards.
Right. And I mean, that seems almost bizarre.
It creates a weird disconnect when you think about it.
You know.
Or
you know, I have to... I mean, even other superstitions, it's like, I've drawn my sword, I have to get blood.
Yep.
You know, otherwise, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know whether you call it an honor issue or something else. It's like, there's almost like a set, you know, an unknown set of rules. I mean, some of this is not necessarily superstitions, mm-hmm. but it does feel almost that same mechanism almost.
Okay. One of my personal favorites is the old ancient Greek story of the marathon, how the guy ran himself nearly to death and died a few days later, but the Spartans took a few days because they were in the middle of a religious celebration and they almost didn't catch up in time. Because of it, you know, because you don't want to piss off the gods because, well, we've read enough Greek tales and know what horrible things happen. But unfortunately, one of the side effects of superstitions is you have to be careful with them because they often reinforce incredibly negative stereotypes or attitudes. Like, most women are treated incredibly horribly in fairy tales. Simple as that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like the mother-in-law is the most terrifying creature in all of folklore. Whether she's a witch, whether she's just a mean old woman, doesn't matter. Well, as soon as you get to a certain age, like a princess is a good thing, but a queen is a bad thing.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. The stepmother.
Small people.
Yes.
Yeah. A lot of those things.
You know, and ultimately, this is almost one of those rule zero ones. If you're going to use any sort of this stuff here, talk about some of the more conventional stuff and see what works within your party or what will cause a trigger effect.
Yeah.
And be respectful, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and I was just, I don't know why, but I was just thinking of other things too, where I wouldn't call them superstitions, but I remember, I had this book one time and it talked about, you know, things people would do with ghosts, You know, it's like, oh, if you want to see a ghost, you look between the ears of like a dog or a cat or something bizarre. And I was thinking, well, that's interesting. It's like, what if that actually worked in a game? You know? Exactly. Or, you know, to temporarily dispel a ghost, you throw a key at it so it can't affect you.
Exactly. Or, you know, like, to pull back to Rifts, horses, cats, and dogs can see the supernatural. That's why they ended up genetically engineering dog boys. Because they could sense magic before people could.
Hmm.
So take the superstition to its logical extreme and then change it.
Hmm.
Interesting. Yeah.
And, like, is there a particular set of folklore that really catches your fancy?
You know, not necessarily folklore, but I do, you know, I remember growing up, definitely a lot of the old fairy tales. I don't know why, but we had this book of fairy tale stories.
Mm-hmm.
And that definitely always affected me, because some of them were, you know, like, oh, you know, I don't know, even know what fairy tale this is. I just remember bits and pieces of it, like some orphan boy that was raised by a bear.
I think I remember it, but only in the back of my head.
Yeah, and it it's like, you know, turned out he was kind of a prince or something like that, and eventually he married the princess, and the bear was allowed at the wedding or something bizarre like that. Exactly. And just like,
one of the best retellers is a lot of these old tales is actually really old now, but it's when Jim Henson did his The Storyteller, and he took a lot of the stories and redid them with his puppeteering, and it was just amazing.
Well, he was an amazing guy.
I could call him the great storyteller for a reason. But other things you might get a kick out of, like, here's another one of those ones where you really have to be careful, but I consider him one of the better storytellers of the 19th century, or 19th, 20th century, Uncle Remus. He's an amazing storyteller, but it's a product of its time. And you got to be careful when you cross certain lines, because certain words that weren't offensive during its era are incredibly offensive now.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's, I think, again, like, you've hit it on the head with a lot of folklore, a lot of superstitions. There's a lot of that, you know, depending on what you read, you know, so much of it is a product of its time. Mm-hmm. For a more modern person or a person that lives today with whatever current sensibilities we have, it does read really weird and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it is tough to put aside the fact that you're like, wow, that's kind of, or that, not only is that kind of, that is really maybe racist or whatever, or immoral, but at the time it wasn't.
No, right. It's considered smart behavior or ethical behavior.
Right. You know,
trickery thing there.
Well, yeah, I mean, just even certain words for certain people, you're just like, okay. But I mean, that was, at the time that it was written, that was a socially acceptable term.
Yeah.
And it's like, what are you going to do, rewrite it? You know, and well, in some...
Like, there's actually a term that became racist after the fact, even though the original event wasn't. It involves, Brer Rabbit and involving...
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. And, but also, another big thing about superstitions is they fuel monster manuals. Literally, you take a tale from a weird superstition and so forth, and a lot of creatures that were in the monster manual upon monster manual came from folklore.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the troll, the skeleton, the bear white,
the ghoul.
The ghoul.
I mean, hell, you want to see some strange creatures. The medieval bestiaries were always filled with creatures that made no sense.
Well, they didn't have to worry about things like science or basic physiology.
But it was weird because people actually believed that those things existed. Mm-hmm. You know, and you're like, okay. And I mean, in many ways, that segues into here where, you know, there are... And I guess that's an interesting thing. You know, think about a fantasy game that already has strange creatures. You know, so you already have a leg up where people believe there are strange creatures. And then someone comes out with something like, oh, that must really exist. So,
where's the line?
Yeah, well, there is no, I mean, where's the line? But I mean, I would think that would be interesting that, almost like, to me, it's almost like, again, the Scooby-Doo scenario where it's like, there could be a lot of people faking these creatures just because.
I was just thinking of a scenario where you know, somebody says that there's a, you know, there's a new creature around that's populating quickly and it is preparing to take over the town, and how you could, you know, that would cause a panic amongst the townspeople, and it would be up to the players to kind of defuse the situation before they took it out on some other local populace or something like that.
Yeah.
So that'd be kind of all kinds of interesting stuff you could do with that.
Oh, definitely. Like, one of my favorite and one of the silly things actually comes from the old 80s Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles TV show, where you could have mutants, you could have aliens, you could have weird technology. But both Splinter and Shredder were adamant there are no ghosts. There are no ghosts. And there was never a ghost in the entire episode series. In fact, they went out of their way to point out that there were no ghosts. It was usually something else.
Hmm.
So it was actually one of those funny things, like, maybe one of those superstitions is bluntly wrong, but it's something else.
Yeah.
Hmm.
All right. Interesting. Well, why don't we wrap this one up and get into the Kickstarters and get this episode in the can. What do you guys say?
Sounds good.
All right.
That works.
Well, let's start with, probably the one I find interesting. I think a lot of people will. It has a huge goal. Has 41 days to go. It's looking for, dare I say, $250,000.
I saw that.
Whoa. That's a lot of change.
Yep. It is Frank Metzer's Imperia fantasy setting?
Imperia.
For 10 RPG systems, including, obviously, D&D, 5th Edition, Pathfinder, RuneQuest, Savage Worlds, DCC, Castles and Crusades,
Swords and Wizardry,
Hackmaster, D&D, and 1st and 2nd Edition D&D. I mean, you take it, he delivers.
Yeah, well, dude, he has his one of Fides. He was the personal aide of Igor Gaiax back in the day. And he's definitely, I remember hearing that name many, many times throughout fiction. I just think he's reaching a little higher than his, you know, options are.
That's kind of where I'm, well, that's what the Kickstarter says too. I mean, he's at 43,000. That's a long way to go.
Yeah,
even so, in 41 days.
So, we'll see. Well, I mean, that's the only thing I can say. I just thought it was very interesting to see this come out.
I wonder why the high price. I mean, that's a really big ticket.
He has definitely some of the artwork is going to cost him.
He's bringing out classical characters because he's been around for 40 years, and you hear names like David Zeb Cook, Ed Greenwood, Alan Hammack, Tracy Hickman,
right,
Skip Williams, James M. Ward, a name I haven't heard since frickin' Deities and Demigods.
Yeah.
Like, he's obviously got the connections. I just don't think he has the fundraising ability.
Yeah. No, it will be very interesting to see, and we will we'll watch this one. I just thought that was kind of an interesting, I don't know what this, you know, how do I put this? Not that I, it'll be interesting to see what this really has compared to anything else you can buy. I think that's the biggest problem. Really, really people buying this are buying his name and buying, like, especially when you look at the artists that are associated with it, they're buying the artist's name. Yeah. That, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, what does it have? It doesn't, I don't see anything about it that says that it's anything other than your bog standard fantasy world.
Yeah.
Done by the people doing it are more legendary than what the world looks like.
Yeah, it kind of feels like it's the most amazing cake ever composed by the amazing cooks. But you know what they say about too many cooks?
Ruins them.
I think at this point, I don't know how he's marketing it, to be honest with you.
I don't quite
see ads for it on EN World and stuff like that, but I don't know that it's that's not going to cut $250,000.
No, dude. Even Monty Cook doesn't ask for that much, and I'd argue he's one of the best fundraisers of all time on Kickstarter.
Yeah, well,
for a game.
I guess we'll watch this one and see what happens.
Yeah.
Because it has 40 days, so in 2 weeks we'll come back and see what its total is.
Yeah. Well, if anybody wants to come on and tell us all about this game and why it's the best thing since sliced bread, let us know.
Again, I think a lot of it's name recognition.
Yeah.
That's where it's at. So
it's right there. It's right there in the name of the Kickstarter, Frank Mentzer's Imperia.
Yeah.
All right. Again. So next up we have Orbis Mundi 2, Real Medieval Life.
I am probably going to back this.
Yeah.
This looks really, really interesting.
It's expanded and updated the version of the original Orbis Mundi, covering the reality of medieval European life for role players. I like this idea. I can't back it because I can't really back anything right now.
Yeah, 100%.
The core book is going to be 400 plus pages.
Yeah. I mean, and what are they asking? $15 or $12 US for the PDF.
And if you want the print versions, you can get them for $35, not counting the cost of shipping.
Right.
Okay.
Still not bad. I like this because it's like, again, this is one of my central conceits with a lot of fantasy games, is that they were all very medieval based. And we moved on to the Renaissance, but I love the medieval period more.
Yeah.
I mean, as a kid, I was always interested. And that's how it got me into D&D, was it's like, I always was very interested in you know, the castles and the knights, you know, that whole system. And it's like, that's what got me into D&D. It wasn't, and honestly, in many ways, it really wasn't the fantasy portion. It was like, the setting is set in medieval, so it's a fantasy set in medieval where there's actual wizards. Okay, that's cool too.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I don't know if.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I mean, sometimes I really do feel like modern fantasy is a real pale thing.
It's become very homogenized and. It has become so player-centric to the point that, games have to kind of, the world doesn't kind of exist outside the players. And I think, when you put it back when you're talking about medieval stuff, medieval times, you end up with this world that exists very much outside the players of, you know, you can't just wander around the countryside with a sword.
You're not suited for that thing. Otherwise, you end up in the woods.
If you leave your shire, somebody has to pay for the fact that you're leaving your place of birth, because the feudal lord is losing labor by you taking off to go adventuring or crusading or whatever.
Or you end up as a wolf's head.
So
Ferdinand Negranda, you're basically going to be killed with impunity. And unless your name is Robin Hood and Little John, you're probably not going to live very long.
So, I mean, yeah, it is the medieval period. I've been listening to a book right now on it. It's fascinating. And, yeah, it bears little resemblance to our contemporary fantasy worlds.
Yeah, I mean, most contemporary fantasy worlds remind me of, it's modern life, but with magic.
Yep.
Yeah. It actually has more in common with Shrek than anything else.
Yeah. Mm.
I could see that. So, interesting. I can't back it, but I'd love to because I think it's going to be interesting.
I think I'm going to have to back this one. And he said that the PDF's actually already done. So, this will be delivered almost, the core book will be delivered almost instantaneously. So,
that's cool. I like it. Yeah. All right. So, next up we have Limitless Monsters, 100 D&D 5th Edition Monsters. Well, everyone needs more monsters, I guess. So, he was asking, what was that?
Monsters are always fun, at least as far as the conceptual model is concerned.
Yeah. So, asking $5,000 has six right about now. And I do like this because it has, the way he describes it, it's like, it contains 100 unique monsters, dozens of illustrations, lore mechanics to unlock tactical insights through knowledge. That's cool. Monster tactics, which I think is really interesting, because I know sometimes even as a game master, I'm like, how is this monster supposed to work?
Yep.
So I do like that. And it says pre-roll treasure for DM prep time. Well, okay. That's kind of okay. And then it has 300 further adventure hooks to aid in follow-up quests. So I kind of like the concept. I mean, I think what really draws me is the whole lore mechanic thing and the monster tactics. I think that's kind of cool.
Well, again, yeah. I love ecologies of monsters. And how you explain them, how they work within their particular biome. And this definitely hits I don't know if I pick it up per se, but it definitely amuses me terribly. It's going to be put on the fence for sure.
Yeah, and right now, $15 for the PDF, which is about in line with what we've seen for PDFs these days.
Yeah, plus it's paid for, so you know, you'll just throw $15 at it, you're probably going to get the PDF.
Yeah.
Whether it's, you know, what's this guy's bona fides?
I mean, and again, here's another one that's even more monster. Different Kickstarter. I don't know how you pronounce it. Would you say Aquile?
Aquile, yeah.
Aquile?
Aquile, Beastry of the Realm, Dark Obelix.
Right. And so that's like a setting or something, right? I forget. Because I know we've seen that before.
Rings a bell, but
yeah.
Doesn't know me here.
Again, 400 monsters.
Yep.
I think the only thing that I fear with some of these monsters is that they're either repetitive or dumb.
Yeah. Well, dude, I've seen the Fiend Folio. We cannot say that we're making dumb monsters. Yeah, there's a tradition of making dumb monsters. Like, even though I actually wrote it into one of my modules, the Flail Snail, really?
Yeah. Well,
looking at the illustration, they have the skeleton, which is supposed to be the skeleton of an Etten, or is it an Etten? Yeah. Is that what they were called?
Yeah.
Is that really a new monster?
Yeah, it looks more like a skinning or a minor template at best.
At best.
You know, honestly, this is going to sound weird, but one of my favorite articles, I don't know what Dragon magazine it actually came out of, but it was in the Best of the Dragon Volume 1, was random monsters. Not random encounters, random monsters. It was a set of tables that you just rolled on, and it generated a completely random monster.
Wait, yeah, I think I saw something like that. That's actually kind of a fun thing to play with.
Yeah, because
I have that magazine. I just don't have it with me right now.
Yeah, and I always thought that was great because you had completely unique monsters. Well, relativistically, you know, because obviously it was off some tables, but it's like, hey, you know, this is a monster. It has no name. It's just a monster. Well, what is it? You don't know.
Well, again, that's something that, unfortunately, the side effect of really good monster manuals is they become damned with their own success. Because then, you know, it's that monster. That monster is awesome. Unfortunately, I now know everything about it because I bought the book. Yeah. And therefore, I know how to defeat it, even though it's got a weird defeating pattern. I've read the book.
Yeah.
So I know to pull out my silver weapons or my magical bell from a cow or something.
Yeah. So, all right, let's go on. Let's move on. We have Mutiny Masterminds book, Superpowered Legions. Legions. Superpowered Legends source book for Mutiny Masterminds. It's actually reached its goal. It was only asking like $1,500. Either one of you guys do Mutiny Masterminds?
No.
Yeah, I don't either. I think, I hate to say it, but as much as I love superheroes, and I like the idea of running an RPG that is superheroes, I don't think it works well.
It has never worked well for me, I can tell you that. Yeah. It's one of the most difficult genres I've ever had to run.
Well,
even though it seems simple.
Well, if there's any genre where you need to set up an episode zero for, I'd argue Supers is the one where you have to really lay down the ground rules. Otherwise, you end up with this weird hodgepodge of characters that have no connective tissue.
You also have to spell the comic book mindset, too.
Yeah, because you can't pull a MacGuffin out of your ass to save in the third act, unless that's part of the actual mechanics itself.
Right.
Like, I love Spider-Man as much as the next one, but sometimes he goes back and uses science to save the day or some other trick here, or you put an X there. And that's one of the easier ones to deal with. Say somebody like Superman or Silver Surfer or somebody really powerful. Unless it's a more narrative system like Fate, why are you in danger? Then why are you doing it?
Yeah, it's a tough, you know, and I know people have run successful campaigns for years, and more power to them. Yeah. It has not worked for me.
Yeah, like I would argue that if you're going to use a superhero campaign, I wouldn't actually base on any of the comics, but I would actually look at professional wrestling of all things, on how to tell a story using superheroes and villains.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's an interesting observation. I've never really thought about that.
I could really see that.
You know, because you got the acts, you got the drama, you got the storytelling, you got the trash talk, but it's built within a mechanism. And you just simply take the ring out of there and you replace it with bank robbery.
Hmm. All right. Next up, we have Drag and Drop Adventures 5th Edition Volume 3. So, again, I'm always a fan of more adventures just to have, just for, hey, you never know.
Mm-hmm.
And looks like this one is for 9th to 12th level, which, I don't know why, but especially in D&D, after about 6th level, I don't care what system it is, 6th or 7th level, I kind of get bored.
It's not nearly as bad in 5th edition as it was in previous editions, but after about 11th edition, it causes the aha levels where you're basically playing countermeasures with the GM.
Right.
But 5th edition has its own problem. It's why you're collecting gold, but that's my own personal beef, which I will talk to at a later date. Because gold, you really can't do anything with other than buy a castle and maybe some real estate, in which case you're playing papers and paychecks.
But, you know, that's true, but especially with when you look at early first edition D&D, and even before that, mm-hmm. really, as you went up in level, the game was supposed to shift to a more meta.
Yep. Yep.
And I mean, that's one of those things people forget, is that that's why, I mean, you had all these powers, but it would shift.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually you'd be, you know, it'd become more political. That was always the assumption in the game, I think.
Yeah, mm-hmm. but there was no mechanical, you know, there was no mechanical support for a lot of it.
No, I'm not saying there was. I'm just saying that was like a weird conceit. I think but a lot of players are like, I don't want to build a castle, then who cares? Why do you care what the gold is? Once you reach a certain level of wealth, it's like you have more money than you'll ever need.
Yeah. Considering, you know, the average third level character probably makes more money in a lifetime than any peasant.
Yeah.
And then you're basically 15th level, like, that's when you get into what I call the magical arms race.
Yeah, well, it is. I think you get into the magical arms race long before that, but...
Yeah.
All right, well, again, still, you never know. You might need adventures.
And your goal, so...
Well, it looks like a fun little adventure, and it's kind of a fun little story arc. Like, I'd imagine it looks like, you know, without knowing the writer himself, I'd say it's worth a shot, because it's relatively cheap.
Yeah. So, next up we have I like the idea, but I think they're asking for too much money. Was Dangerous Places Illustrated Cards to Inspire Adventures. And it's a set of 30 5x7 two-sided illustrated cards. With some, look, I mean, from what it looks like pen and ink drawings, which I love.
Yeah, those are really, I really like those, yeah.
You know? It's definitely my wheelhouse. I just think...
Ouch. They got a long way to go.
Yeah, they have a long way to go. They're asking $9 for the digital version. I would have said maybe a few thousand at best, but $9,400, and I don't know if that's because they have to pay somebody for the artwork.
Well, maybe they can give us a breakdown or something, but they haven't even broken 1,000 yet.
Yeah, no. I like the idea of this, but... Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, this is one where if they fail, you want them to come back next round.
Right. I personally think that they will fail, and I'm not trying to jinx them by any means. And I hope that they come back with a more reasonable goal.
Yeah. Yes.
Again, you know, baby steps. You gotta get your market out there, and you gotta have a fan base before you start pushing anything beyond a couple thousand.
You know,
this is their first one,
they did actually reach down their breakdowns. They said 5,000 for design costs.
Yeah.
You know, and like 3,800 to 7,800 for printing costs, and then, you know, 2,000 to 3,000 for shipping handling and storage costs. And then I guess the Kickstarter fees, they're going between $900 to $1,200. So it says this leaves us with a shortfall between $2,400 and $5,000 even after funding.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's like, this leaves us with a shortfall between this, even if we're already set aside this money, believable that break even would be lovely, but this is unlikely. We prepare for the worst, financially speaking. I hate to tell them, but I wouldn't do this.
No,
yeah.
This screams heartbreaker right off the top of the head.
Yeah.
Like, here's my opinion. If the Kickstarter fails, lower your expectations. Don't go through anyways. The only person you're going to hurt is yourself in the process.
Yeah, I think they
like baby steps. Learn your market the hell out of it. Go on podcasts, talk to people, go to cons. You gotta almost spend a year advertising any product before you actually bring it out.
I think they need to increase the number of cards that they have involved there. 30 cards is
60 images.
Oh, let's try that. That's true. They're two-sided. Okay, fair enough.
You know, but even
as long as both sides are different images, yeah.
Right. I'm just thinking that from a cost analysis that they've done, this is a bad deal for them.
Yep.
And again. I mean, it kind of reminds me of watching Shark Tank, and having, you know, the people trying to get the shark's money and be like, "Hey, I'll give you $20,000, but I'm taking 50% of your company," and someone taking that.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, that's a bad deal for you, period. You know, mm-hmm. You may get some money out of it, but you don't have your company anymore. And that's how I kind of feel with what they're doing, is that you're going to lose a lot. You're going to lose a lot of money. It's going to be a big heartbreaker.
Dude, nothing sucks more than something you love becoming something you hate.
Exactly. You know, and you know what? I'd be happy if I'm wrong on this one for them. I would love to be wrong on something like this, but I look at this one and it really does scream heartbreaker.
Yep. Well, we wish them luck, but we also tell you, don't bet the farm on this one.
Yeah.
Guys, I don't care if you have the money, don't do it. It doesn't make money.
And this one, the next one up, also screams heartbreaker, because they're asking for $55,000 and they got eight and a half, maybe. Stout-hearted heroes, Dungeoneers. And they say they're the first and only 3D printable line of 30mm tabletop miniatures. I don't think that's true. Is that true?
If it's true, that's semantics. It's they look awesome. They actually look pretty well designed. They also look kind of like chibi, but
I think I'm guessing that's the style that we're looking for.
Yeah.
I have a hard time believing that they're the first and only. I can almost certainly guarantee, well, just from experience on the show, we've seen stuff like this before.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
I'm guessing they're probably going for the 30mm as opposed to like an 8mm.
Or 28. Are they splitting hairs by saying, well, they're 30mm, not 28mm.
Yep, we use 30mm.
Like, you don't want to mark it because it might not be the proper gauge for your typical tabletop.
So, I mean, granted, they do look good, and I do have to say, I do like their little hawk bear miniature. Yeah. Calling it a hawk bear instead of an owl bear to avoid the copyright issues.
Yeah.
But
I do like, like I said, they're pretty. I like the idea. I like the concept. And I think it's safe to assume in the next 5 years,
this will be the way.
Go completely 3D.
Yeah. So, that said, let's move over to the other printable miniatures that we have, which is printable Starship miniatures.
Ooh, in theme.
What was that?
In theme.
Yeah. It's a. I mean, I kind of like this one because, well, I'm a sucker for starships, but I would hardly use them, sadly.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the idea, and this guy, $400 is what he's looking for. For his goal, he's more than reached it, and let's see what it is. It's like $4 for one model, and then like goes up to $7 for two. To get all 11 models is $32. That's not bad. I mean, that's obviously just the STL files that you need to do on your 3D printer. But I like it, and generally speaking, I like the designs that he has. I love the little, I don't know if that's supposed to be a little transport ship with the little double rings. That's yep. cool looking.
Mm-hmm.
So,
not disagreeing. But again, I'm a sucker for the old contra-gravity transports where they have to basically turn instead of having artificial gravity, you know, due to MacGuffin.
Yep. All right, and last up, we have the steel bar magnet pivoted Game Master screen. We've seen a lot of these Game Master screens that are made out of wood recently.
Yeah, we saw one not too long ago.
Yeah.
That was a little exorbitantly priced, though.
Yeah. This one...
It looks nice.
It looks nice, but I hate to tell them, this is another one of those ones that once you see it, you're like, oh, well, I could do that. And it is... Yeah. Now, that said, this is a UK... One, I believe, because based on it's in pounds. Mm-hmm. Although it says it ships anywhere in the world, but I still go to the theme of well, this looks cool, but this is something like I would rather you would make and you would sell like at a local convention.
Yeah,
I'm not trying to
laser etching on the wood, which is kind of neat. But I mean, the art on any screen kind of becomes part of the background, as it were, at the table after a couple of times.
Yeah, and it's
like, oh, that looks cool, but then, you know, a couple times later, nobody even notices it.
Yeah, that, and it's like the cost of one is $94 US.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
So, I'm sorry, but. Outside of the little magnet thing that he has going on, I can probably cut a piece of wood and stain a piece of wood and put hinges on it.
Well, it's more than that, man. Like, if I have a GM screen, you know what I want on it? Tables, quick notes on both sides.
Yeah.
So that when people are looking up this rule here, it's already right in front of them.
That $94 gets you a plain one with no etching on it. So it's just three pieces of wood hinged together.
Yep, so there we go. That's just kind of sad. All right, well, why don't we wrap this up and get the hell out of here? What do you guys say?
Did you want to hit the bundle of holding real quick?
Oh, right.
What's in the bundle of holding?
There's just two of them.
Okay.
So this week we have Over the Edge. The basic bundle is $8.95, and the extended bundle is $20. So if you're looking to get into the classic game of high conspiracy weirdness, this is a great way to do it. A game I played. I think it might do better with a different system. I wasn't really super impressed with the system, but it's still a fascinating game, a really interesting setting. If you want to mix James Bond with a bit of supernatural or you know, kind of high weirdness, this is the way to do it. And the other one is Maelstrom. The basic bundle is $11.95, and the extended bundle is $25, about $25. And this is actually, I don't actually know that much about this one. It was published by Puffin Books back in the 80s.
Ooh, that's a name I haven't heard in a while.
And it was kind of published alongside the Fighting Fantasy stuff. And it looks like they've revamped some of it, and they're coming out with a new version. So they have released the classic game, along with some new supplements and stuff like that. So,
all right, well, very cool. And with that, we're gonna say if there's anything you want to tell us, go ahead and shoot us an email at info@rbcircus.com. If you want to, you can go to our Facebook page, leave us a comment there. You can go to our Google+ page, leave us a comment there. I know there's just way too many. And, you know, if you go to either the RPG Circus homepage or Facebook, you will, there's a link there to send us a voicemail, which I don't think a lot of people have done lately, which is sad. It breaks my heart. So please send us a voicemail. I'd love to hear from you guys.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else? Or can we just say... We can say adieu.
Adieu.
Just the basic stuff. If you have anything about vehicles that you want to put your two cents in, or if you have a preferred superstition, let us know.
Exactly. And we'll see everyone in 2 weeks.
See ya.
RPG Circus is released on a Creative Commons Attribution US License 3.0. For more information, please visit creativecommons.org.